Well, I want to thank the organizers for the invitation to come here. I guess I'm here to provide cultural diversity. I'm the only extra dimension speaker, I guess. And so before I start, though, I think I'll do something in very bad taste and use one conference to advertise another. SUSY 2003 is going to be held at the University of Arizona. And even if you don't work on supersymmetry, that's okay. SUSY, I just learned, actually stands for souping up the standard Eur. So this is basically all of physics beyond the standard model, and it does include neutrino masses and oscillations, and also connections to astrophysics and cosmology. So it'll be held June 5th through 10th, and we're hoping for a large turnout, and it should be fun. And depending on the weather, it'll either look more like this or like that. Probably more like this. So anyway, the website will be up in about a week, and everyone is urged to register and come, and it promises to be a nice, stimulating time. So hope to see you there. What will the temperature in June be? Well, the politically, I would rather say, oh, a mere 90 or so, but it might be a little warmer than that. However, as we say in Arizona, it's a dry heat. And whatever it is, it's 5 degrees cooler than Phoenix, so no, really, everything will be inside the hotel, and it'll all be nice and air-conditioned, and really, it's not what you think. You do not perspire, you simply burn. No, really. Okay, so I was asked to talk today about neutrinos in extra dimensions, and since I am the only extra dimension speaker, I responded and said, should I give a kind of self-contained review talk? And they said, absolutely. So what I'll try to do very quickly is set out the whole paradigm before I get into details. So first I'll just talk about why people talk about extra dimensions. I'll quickly review this. I'm sure most of you have seen it, the idea being that it lowers the fundamental scales of physics. I'll then propose the main mechanisms, which are that neutrinos, right-handed neutrinos, might exist in the bulk, that they have these extra space-time dimensions that they can feel. I'll show how this might lead to new scenarios for having light neutrinos without having heavy mass scales. And I'll talk about some physics, and then I'll talk about possibilities for adding flavor into these models, and I'll talk about one particular set of models. And although I'm sure many of you have seen the early parts of this before, this will be some new physics. And in particular, I'll talk about how one might build a very compact model for neutrino oscillations. And I'll even talk about how the MSW effect looks in the presence of extra dimensions. And then if there's time, I'll also talk about some other things you may not have seen before, in particular how these kind of physics may also be used to explain some features of axion physics as well. And this is work done in collaboration with Emilian Dudov, Tony Gargetta, and Ina Sharchevich. So let me review very quickly by reminding you that extra dimensions are a big field nowadays, and there are lots of reasons why. Starting with Kaluza and Klein, but more recently in string theory, we believe that there should be extra dimensions. They may or may not be big. And I want to stress right at the beginning that there are really two different kinds of extra dimensions that people talk about. And I will and it's important to understand that there are two very different kinds. One I'll call universal. These are extra dimensions that all forces, including gauge forces, would feel. And therefore, accelerator experiments can probe them. And so therefore, we do not see extra dimensions down to the scale currently probed by accelerators. And this is in the hundreds of GeV or TeV range. So that's the bound on universal extra dimensions. But the kind that's attracted more attention recently has been these, what I'll call gravity-only extra dimensions. The idea being here that the gauge forces in particles, things that carry gauge charges, non-zero gauge quantum numbers under SU3, SU2, or U1, are restricted to brains, membranes, or D-brains. And so we live in a four-dimensional universe, which is a brain, and the only kind of particle that can possibly, as string theory suggests, that can possibly leave the brain and propagate into what's called the bulk, the extra dimensions beyond the brain, are particles which are gauge neutral, and in this case, the graviton. So only the gravitational force can leave. Because of that, only gravity feels this kind of extra dimension, so accelerators really don't probe them directly, and instead you have to test gravity itself, and the bounds really here are a lot weaker there. For. They're in the millimeter, really sub-millimeter, really even tens or even hundreds of micron ranges. So these are the current bounds. A lot bigger these can be because they're only felt by gravity. So historically, these were always considered to be at the Planck scale. People weren't concerned about them. And in the past 3 or 4 years, the new thing has been to ask what would happen if the extra dimensions are not as small as the Planck scale. In particular, what if the corresponding Kaluza-Klein states, these resonances off, these echoes off the fifth dimension, are lighter if the extra dimensions are bigger? What would happen if these KK states are light? What effects would they have on physics beyond the standard model? And the question, and the answer turned out to be that large extra dimensions would have the power to alter the fundamental high energy scales of physics. And what high, yes?
Just a quibble. In the previous transparency, in principle, the analysts can look for this by testing for loss of causality. Right? There will be
there are apparent violations of lots of things. There are apparent losses of energy because things can propagate into the bulk. But
things should come in from that.
That's right. All I'm saying is that the absence of KK states down in accelerator experiments down to or up to GeV or hundreds of GeV energy scales does not mean that these extra dimensions could not themselves be millimeter sized. That was the point. Of course, accelerators can be used to probe this as well in the TeV range. So the idea has been that if we imagine that these extra dimensions are large and they have the potential to lower the fundamental scales of physics, and I'm thinking of high energy scales such as the Gut scale, the Planck scale, and the String scale. So let me just quickly remind you how that works. Let me just first talk about the Gut scale. Again, this is very old work. I'm just trying to show how to set the stage. So the Gut scale is set by the unification of gauge couplings, by the standard argument. Gauge couplings run logarithmically up from their measured values at accelerators, and that sets a Gut scale. But what happens if there are large extra dimensions of the universal kind? Well, gauge forces feel them, so when you calculate the running of gauge couplings in the loop, you now have to include not only the particles that you see, but also all of their Kaluza-Klein excitations, these resonances off the fifth dimension. And what that does, I'm just going quickly, but what that does is it provides not only a logarithmic running, but it also now gives you a power law running. The preponderance of Kaluza-Klein states in the loops ends up converting a running which was logarithmic to power law. You expect that from dimensional analysis also, because in higher dimensions the gauge couplings themselves become dimension full. So you wind up with a power law running, and what the power law running can do is accelerate the scale of unification, so that instead of unifying out at 10 to the 16th GeV, it can unify things down even in the TeV range. And so this is one way in which you can lower the Gut scale. Of course, the other fundamental scale, even more important perhaps, is the Planck scale. And that was the original idea of Arkani, Hamed, Demopoulos, and Diwali, that extra dimensions off the brain, or in other words, the gravity-only kind, can lower the Planck scale. And the idea is basically the same. You can, and I'm going to show it not in the geometric picture with flux lines as you're used to, but just a different way of thinking about it, which will be useful in a minute. The fundamental strength for the gravitational interaction is set by G Newton. So you construct a dimensionless coupling, G Newton tilde, and as a function of the energy scale at which you probe. And so you plot the inverse coupling just as you would do for the gauge couplings, and you ask, when does this become order one, which defines the Planck scale? So gravity starts out incredibly weak. This is on an exponential scale now. It falls like mu to the minus 2 as a function of the energy scale. So the Planck scale is set by where that hits order 1. But if you have extra dimensions that only gravity feels, you have graviton contributions as well. That changes the running in n extra dimensions from mu to the minus 2 to the mu to the minus 2 plus n, and causes an increase power law contribution. There already was a power law contribution for gravity, but now it becomes even more enhanced. And so the Planck scale, the scale at which this coupling hits order 1, falls. And if you adjust from the slope and the radius at which you turn this on, you find that you can lower the Planck scale to the TeV range for millimeter extra dimensions, or 10 to the minus 4 EV. And then by playing with this, you can adjust the scale of gravity, quantum gravity, as you wish by changing the radius and the number of extra dimensions. So again, the basic idea is that extra dimensions give rise to power law running or enhanced power law contributions. And then you can ask about lowering the String scale as well. And basically, String theory requires 6 or perhaps 7 extra dimensions. And so some of these can be in the brain or universal, and those can be used to lower the Gut scale, for example. The remainder of them can be perpendicular to the brain to lower the Planck scale. So that could, those could be the millimeter or submillimeter ones. And together, if you balance things correctly according to the equations of String theory, you can wind up with a self-consistent String theory with a low String scale and therefore have no high energy scales at all. So the new picture that describes the framework that most of the workers in this field are talking about when they consider large extra dimensions is some combination or configuration of extra dimensions in the brain and perpendicular to the brain, such that gauge forces feel some of them, gravity feels all of them, and together you have a unification not only of the gauge couplings but also the gravitational coupling, all at some relatively low scale, which might be in the TeV range if one should be so lucky, and in general is adjustable. Supernova data? Right. Sure. I could if you want, but I wasn't planning to because... Yeah, I can in fact argue with those a little bit because they're assuming very specific kinds of toroidal compactifications, and one doesn't have to be that precise. You can eliminate some of those bounds, some. But my point is not to show the bounds. This is the framework I'm talking about, and I just wanted to present the framework here, but sure, we can talk about it. Yeah.
When we lived?
Yes. Yes.
It
was the same was being done here. I'm not advocating this as a replacement for supersymmetry.
What I'm wondering is this a separate miracle or is this the same?
It's a similar miracle. It's the same miracle. I don't want to say it's exactly the same. All right. You might think there's a little bit of fine-tuning involved. For example, if I change the radius, do I upset the unification? Turns out that this is a plot of what happens if I change the radius at which I turn on the Kaluza-Klein states. Here is a low radius at about 1 TeV, so the unification happens about 20 TeV. Here I wait till 10 to the 8th GeV, and it comes an order of magnitude later, and so forth. Now, there's precision. These lines are not exactly meeting perfectly. One can add extra states to make it more precise. I don't want to claim that this minimal scenario is as precise as the MSSN, but still, there are going to be threshold effects anyway. This is a natural embedding into higher dimensions, but the question is how do you embed the standard model or the MSSM into higher dimensions, and that's going to determine whether or not this works or not. Okay, so the point of this was simply to review that the framework we have is one in which there are no high energy scales left. The type 1 scale, the string scale has been lowered to some number, say 10 TeV. All the forces are unifying in some way because one has arranged the geometry of the space in such a way that there are brains, there are extra dimensions in the brains, perpendicular to the brains, various things people talk about, and one plays with scenarios like this. And so the questions of high energy become now the questions of geometry. Okay, that's the framework that people are talking about, and clearly there's been a lot of work. And what I'd like to do is focus on neutrinos now. And, of course, the moral of the story so far from this would suggest that you have high four-dimensional fundamental scales of physics, which are now being replaced by lower, higher-dimensional fundamental scales. And so the question is, are there any evidences at all for high fundamental scales? And of course, there is one in neutrino physics. There's the seesaw scale. And in particular, it's usually thought to be connected to the gut scale, but we don't have a high gut scale anymore, so how does one go about this? So let me remind you again the standard paradigm now for how we generate light neutrino masses. And the best thing on the market is the seesaw mechanism. And I'll quickly go through it because I want to show you how it will generalize to higher dimensions. But in SO10, well, the presence of a 16 multiplet gives you a right-handed neutrino, which I'll call capital N. We then assume two things, Yukawa couplings and Majorana masses. The Yukawa coupling between the right-handed and left-handed neutrino through a Higgs, and so that gives us some sort of Dirac distribution, which is on the scale of electroweak symmetry breaking, so hundreds of GeV. We also assume a Majorana mass term for the right-handed neutrino, which could happen from some gut physics. People often in SO10 models assume that it happens by breaking some 126 very large representations of SO10 by giving them VEVs at the gut scale. So we imagine some right-handed Majorana mass, which is of the gut scale, unlike the Dirac mass. Then the total mass terms have this form. So this is the matrix we're always talking about. The Dirac mass is on the off diagonal. We have lepton number conservation on the brain, so there's a zero for the left-handed Majorana mass on the brain. And then we have this large Majorana mass in the for the right-handed neutrino. You diagonalize this, you find a light eigenvalue which seesaws against the heavy scale. So if we take something which is fractions of an EV for the eigenvalue, we find the presence of a heavy scale. So light neutrino masses seem to provide further evidence for a high fundamental gut scale. So the question then is, in these scenarios, how can we start doing neutrino physics? How can we start explaining how to get light neutrinos without heavy mass scales? And the fundamental observation, and this is the basis of most of the neutrinos in extra dimension literature, is to realize that unlike all the other fields in the standard model, the right-handed neutrino is a standard model singlet. Doesn't carry color, doesn't carry electroweak charge, and doesn't carry electromagnetic charge. So what that means in string parlance is that it can be realized as a closed string state, not an open string state, which means that it's not restricted to the brain. It doesn't carry a gauge charge. It could act more like a graviton or a gravitino. It can propagate into the bulk. And so if it propagates into the bulk, the way to think of that from a four-dimensional point of view is that this particle, the right-handed neutrino, could have infinite towers of Kaluza-Klein excitations. So now you ask, what happens to neutrino physics if that right-handed neutrino starts having infinite towers of Kaluza-Klein excitations whose masses, 1 over r, 2 over r, 3 over r, and so forth, are set by the radius of those extra dimensions? So there are a number of effects. The first effect is not often talked about, but maybe very important, which is that this gives rise to power law running for the neutrino Yukawa couplings. Because if you think about the Yukawa couplings in some of the diagrams that we normalize them, if you have all sorts of Kaluza-Klein states for the right-handed neutrino running in these loops, then the neutrino Yukawa coupling starts to have a power law, not a logarithmic evolution. And it's possible, if you arrange things correctly, that the neutrino Yukawa coupling can be driven to very small values over a very short energy interval. So this would explain why perhaps neutrino masses are power law suppressed relative to the masses of all the other fermions, because they are coupled to these right-handed neutrinos that have these Kaluza-Klein states running in their loops. Another idea, which is the most popular one, is that there's an additional suppression by the bulk volume factor. Basically, if you imagine that the right-handed neutrino field is sitting in the bulk of extra dimensions, its overlap with the left-handed neutrinos, which are on the brain, the overlap is suppressed by the volume of that large extra dimension, because you have to renormalize the wave function of that large extra dimension, so the overlap becomes very small with the brain. And that overlap is basically the coupling between the right-handed and left-hand, the right-handed bulk neutrino and the left-handed brain neutrino. That's effectively the Dirac coupling. And that also gets suppressed by this dimensionless volume factor for the large extra dimension. So that also explains, perhaps, why one has very light neutrinos without using a heavy scale. Instead, one uses a large volume in both cases. But both of these mechanisms basically suppress the resulting neutrino mass by suppressing the analog of the Dirac mass term, the coupling between the right-handed on the right-handed neutrino in the bulk and the left-handed neutrino on the brain bulk coupling, M, which was formerly the Dirac mass. So the question is whether there might be a higher dimensional analog of the seesaw mechanism altogether. And it turns out that there is. I don't want to go through the algebra, I just want to show you the basic ideas. But as you had before, you can imagine now that there's a mixing. Before, it was between the right-handed neutrino in the bulk, the capital N, and the left-handed neutrino on the brain. But instead, one now has a mixing between the left-handed neutrino on the brain and a whole infinite tower of Kaluza-Klein states, which generalize what had been before a simple single neutrino mass right-handed neutrino term in the bulk, right-handed neutrino. So now we have a mixing between the left-handed neutrino on the brain and all of these Kaluza-Klein modes. And the mixing matrix now has an infinite dimensional size. Basically, it looks in form similar to what we had before. We assume lepton number is conserved on the brain, so we don't, for the standard model, so we don't have any term there. What appears along here is a generalization of the Dirac mass that we had before. These are couplings between the left-handed brain physics and the right-handed bulk physics. For simplicity, let's just take all these little m's to be equal to each other. So that's the brain bulk coupling, which is the analog of the Dirac mass. And then along the diagonal, we have two kinds of contributions. First is a capital M naught, which we can think about as playing the role of the right-handed Majorana mass, the Majorana mass for the field in the bulk. Now, this isn't proper terminology, but it's a useful way to think, perhaps, about the physics of this capital M naught. So let me just call it the bare Majorana mass in the bulk. This is the thing that used to be very heavy in the usual seesaw. It's really not. No, I'm using the wrong words for this. But it's the analog of that. Clearly, it can't really be a Majorana mass. In five dimensions, you don't have such things exactly. I'll discuss that M-naught more carefully in a minute. But it looks, as far as its role in the matrix, like the Majorana mass. And then there are the 1 over R, 2 over R, and so forth terms. Those are the Kaluza-Klein masses. Don't forget, these are masses of the fields in the bulk, and they also contribute along this diagonal. So now you wind up with a mixing matrix that looks like that. And so now you're asking, what is the phenomenology if this becomes your seesaw mechanism? And it turns out that there are a lot of unexpected higher dimensional features that emerge depending on the balance of these parameters. So let's just consider a few cases to see some sorts of things that can occur. So the simplest case that I'll talk about is one in which I'm going to assume that all of the brain bulk couplings, these Dirac masses, are just the same. So a single small m across the first row and the first column, that's our brain bulk coupling. I'll take capital M naught to zero. So I won't even consider this so-called bare Majorana mass in the bulk. So I'll assume essentially that lepton number is being conserved in the bulk. And since it's conserved in the brain, it's now conserved everywhere. So this is a lepton number conserving theory. And so all I have is a single brain bulk coupling, or Dirac mass, and then I have Kaluza-Klein masses. And you can ask, what happens for this? Well, you follow the same procedure you would have followed in four dimensions. The first thing you do is diagonalize. And it's an infinite dimensional mass matrix, but it's actually rather easy to diagonalize. The eigenvalues turn out to be solutions to a transcendental equation of the form lambda r, where lambda is the eigenvalue. And I'm always putting r factors in with masses to make dimensionless quantities. So anything that's dimensionless is because I've scaled it by a radius. So lambda r is cotangent of lambda r, basically. So you can ask, when does this have solutions? So you can plot the lambda r, which is a straight line, and the cotangents, and you ask, when do they have solutions? They have solutions for those values of lambda r where the intersections occur. And so you can see immediately what happens graphically. And so you can immediately look here and say, well, what is the lightest eigenvalue, which would have been what we formerly associated with the neutrino? And you can ask, what is the value of the lightest eigenvalue? The lightest eigenvalue is going to be the one closest to zero, so it's either side. So let me just look at this one. So this is the lightest eigenvalue, and I can ask, what happens as I change the relative strength of the only parameter I've got, the only dimensionless number I have, the brain bulk coupling, or the Majorana, or the Dirac mass, m, times the radius? So as I change the value of this, the straight line that I'm plotting changes its slope effectively. The slope is 1 over mr. So as mr goes to 0, very small extra dimensions or very small couplings, the slope is becoming infinite. So the intersection is sliding all the way up here. So the value of the lightest eigenvalue goes to 0 as mr goes to 0. So that's what you see. The value of the lightest eigenvalue falls to 0 as the brain bulk coupling times the radius falls to 0. The other extreme is when the extra dimension gets very large. When the extra dimension gets very large, lambda r divided by this factor, that's what I'm plotting in this straight line, the slope now goes to 0. So this line is falling to 0, and the intersection for the lightest eigenvalue just falls right to this point, which sits at a half. So the lightest eigenvalue saturates at a half in radius units when the extra dimension gets very large. So now you can immediately read off all of the physics just from this plot. First thing you notice is that all the eigenvalues are paired. So whenever there's a positive one here, there's another one on the opposite side. For one here, there's one here, and so forth. And so what that means is you can basically recombine these Majorana Kaluza-Klein modes into Dirac ones, which makes sense. We never broke lepton number, and so all we have are Dirac masses. That's a check. For very small values of the brain bulk coupling or very small values of the radius, we simply find down here that the eigenvalue lambda r scales linearly like the mass mr, or in other words, the mass of the neutrino itself, the lightest state, just goes like the brain bulk coupling. So this is the limit when you don't have any seesaw behavior. The surprise happens in the other limit. In the other limit, as the radius gets very big, what happens is that this lambda r is saturating at a half. And it does that independently of the value of mr, as long as mr is sufficiently large. So what's happening is that the mass of the eigenvalue becomes always 1 over 2r. And that's independent of the Yukawa coupling. In other words, when the extra dimensions get big, and it's the higher dimensional physics, the intrinsically higher dimensional physics that takes over, what winds up happening is that the mass of the neutrinos starts being set completely by the radius independently of the brain bulk couplings. So you might say, well, that's maybe good or bad, but really, one should not be caring about the neutrino masses. What we really should be caring about are the oscillations that occur. And so once again, one can calculate how these things oscillate. There are oscillations because that mass matrix was not diagonal. So the mass eigenstates were not the same thing as the gauge eigenstates. So you can ask about the oscillations. For example, a neutrino left-handed neutrino to go back into itself after oscillating with these right-handed neutrinos in the bulk. And you have now a sum. It's the usual formula, only for infinite dimensional ones. The coefficients here are the matrix coefficients, where U is the matrix that diagonalizes that mass matrix. So you basically have contributions from oscillations into each KK resonance. And that's why the sum over K is over each KK resonance, where these are the eigenvalues of that transcendental equation. It's very easy to see what happens graphically. You can just look. The first oscillation into the first excited Kaluza-Klein state gives you some sort of simple cosine. Then onto that, you add the oscillation into the second excited Kaluza-Klein state. That gives you a higher harmonic on that cosine or sine. And then the third gives you another one, the fourth gives you another one, and you sum them all up and you get something very jagged and unusual. This is a multi-state or an infinite state component oscillation. And what you do see, though, from here is that, first of all, neutrino oscillations are still effectively periodic. But unlike the usual kinds of scenarios, the deficits and regenerations are never total. You do start from 1, which is hard to see here, but it actually happens. But you never go all the way to 0, and you never come all the way back to 1. So they're never total, which is a clear signal that something is very different from the usual four-dimensional case. Moreover, the oscillation length for this amplitude, for this oscillation, is set now by the first eigenvalue interval, because that's the dominant mode here, the oscillation into the first excited KK state, and that's set by the radius. So the oscillation length, again, is set by the radius in higher dimensions, not by the delta M squareds that we're used to. So if you take a typical delta M squared, say, in the fractions of an EV range, that's what you usually had. Now you would say, I should interpret that as giving me the size of the extra dimension, and the size works out to be something in the submillimeter range. So these are clearly extra dimensions that are perpendicular to the brain, and they're conveniently in the submillimeter range, which is nice. What this is basically saying is we're changing masses, which were submillimeter, into geometry of a size, which is submillimeter. Okay, so that's what happens in that case. Another interesting case is if we let that bare Majorana mass, that capital M naught, not be zero, but instead let's let it take a particular value, which is 1/2 the inverse of the radius. Now, why is that a nice value? It turns out that there's a way to provide a value for this M naught, which comes through the Schirk-Schwarz mechanism. This is a mechanism in string theory, which gives rise to an effective M naught. You can think about this as a kind of global but non-local breaking of lepton number. Basically, as I take a fermion around the loop in the extra dimension, I introduce a topological twist, and what that does is effectively provide a value of M naught. This is a standard trick in string theory for breaking symmetries called the Schirk-Schwarz mechanism. And the question I'm going to look at right now is, what does this do for the neutrino physics? Well, it turns out that this gives you a value for M naught, which, when added to the previous matrix, now turns it into this form. Again, we have the Dirac masses, or the brain bulk couplings, and now we have Kaluza-Klein masses, where we've added this value of M naught. So again, we look at what happens. Same thing, we solve, we diagonalize, we have a new transcendental equation. We used to have lambda r equaled cotangent. Now we have lambda r equals minus tangent. And the difference between minus tangent and cotangent is merely a phase shift. So we have the same plot as we had before, only the cotangents have slid back half a period. So what does that do? Well, you look at the eigenvalues now and you realize the first thing that happens is we have a zero eigenvalue right at the middle. And we have that no matter what the value of M are. There's always an intersection right at the zero. So we see that the lightest eigenvalue is actually massless. And this is true for all values of MR. It's independent of the brain bulk coupling, or in other words, the Dirac mass contribution to the neutrino. And it's robust, therefore. There's no fine-tuning about this. This just happened directly by the Schirk-Schwarz mechanism. And all the other Kaluza-Klein states we see are again paired, this with that, and so forth. And so what we see is that all the other Kaluza-Klein states indeed pair up to be Dirac masses again. So you can ask, what is the zero mode here, this massless neutrino state, and it turns out to look like this. So the actual mass eigenstate neutrino is the left-handed neutrino with an admixture of an infinite number of Kaluza-Klein modes mixed in, suppressed as you go to higher and higher Kaluza-Klein modes, and with the overall coefficient of the admixture given by MR. So if MR is sufficiently small, as you expect for really, for very volume suppressed brain bulk couplings, you expect this number to be very small, what this means is that this mass eigenstate, which is massless, is still going to be mostly a left-handed neutrino with a tiny admixture of these Kaluza-Klein modes. So this is mostly left-handed, as you expect, but this magic combination actually gives you a massless neutrino, exactly, for all values of MR. Well, at first glance, you'd say, well, who cares? Because we don't want a massless neutrino. We know neutrinos have mass. But really what we know is that neutrinos oscillate. And the interesting thing here is that this massless neutrino will oscillate, because even though it's a massless neutrino, it still came from a mixing matrix which was non-diagonal. This is not something we could have had in four dimensions. With the 2x2 seesaw matrix, the only way to get a massless eigenstate was to have a diagonal matrix. Here in this infinite dimensional case, we are led to a scenario where we have a massless eigenstate automatically, even though it's coming from a non-diagonal mass matrix. So again, we can calculate what the oscillations look like, and we find a similar sort of thing. A contribution from the zero mode, then the first harmonic, second harmonic, and so forth. We get something that looks like this. So the first thing we learn is that in higher dimensions, we can have neutrino oscillations without neutrino masses. That's exciting. The oscillations are still effectively... Yes? The masses that are triggering this are not masses of the left-handed neutrinos on the brain. It's really the Kaluza-Klein states in the bulk which are triggering this. But the point is the left-handed neutrinos on the brain can be massless in this kind of scenario.
What are the masses of these Kaluza-Klein?
1 over R, 2 over R, 3 over R, just set by the radius. No, this would have to be something in the millimeter range, or submillimeter range, a hundredths of a millimeter actually, 10 to the minus 5 meters, if you want the wavelengths to be appropriate. I'm not trying to show an actual model here. There are still other problems which I'll get to. So I'm trying to show scenarios, and I'll get to models later. Okay. They're intersterile, and that's why I'm going to have to talk about that. I will come back and talk about the steriles, absolutely. In fact, this is a good prelude to the next talk, which will be all about sterile neutrinos. So, but we still see that we have oscillations, which are effectively periodic. The regenerations are never total, but the deficits are total. Now we do actually hit zero. So this is just a vacuum oscillation, if you will, between right-handed and left-handed neutrinos only. I haven't ever talked about flavor yet. That's coming. And you see already that the time average, is quite a bit less than a half. The oscillation length is again set by the first eigenvalue interval. And again, I can generalize this to flavor oscillations, which I'll do in a minute. And so, just as a kind of cute observation, in such scenarios, neutrino oscillations are not really evidence for neutrino masses as far as the neutrinos on the brain, but rather are evidence for extra dimensions, if you want to be so bold. The question really is, though, how do you talk about flavor? I've only been talking about one left-handed neutrino and its KK mode in the bulk, or its right-handed partner. So the question is, how do I extend to flavor? Well, obviously, I need three left-handed neutrinos on the brain now, E, mu, and tau. The question is, what do I do in the bulk? Well, the most natural thing to do is to say, well, each one of these has a corresponding flavored bulk neutrino, right-handed counterpart in the bulk. That means that what were formerly those brain bulk coupling M's, those little M's in the first row and column, now puff up to become 3x3 mixing matrices for the brain bulk couplings. This gives you a lot of parameters, and there's been a lot of work in trying to understand the phenomenology of these models, including many people, some of whom are here. And there are a lot of parameters. And so one question that emerges is whether there might be another alternative which involves fewer parameters, which one can employ. And so I'd like to show one compact model. So this is work with Ina Sharchevich. And so here's the structure of the model. I'm forced to have three left-handed neutrinos on the brain. So these are my three flavors. So that's the blue part, the brain part. So here they are. And for various technical reasons, I'll assume that they have bare Majorana masses, little MIs, right along here. But I'm going to assume no mixing. I'm going to have the standard model. Here's the MNS mixing matrix on the brain for the standard model. I'm going to take it to be completely diagonal. Everything I'm going to say now has no mixing angles on the brain at all. Standard model is the flavor diagonal theory. I'll have only one bulk neutrino for all three. So here it is in green. And it has the usual Kaluza Klein states running down the diagonal, and that's all. And then I'll have a universal brain bulk coupling. Symbol one value for M for everything. So notice what I'm doing here. I'm building a model which is flavor diagonal on the brain. The bulk theory is flavor neutral, just one bulk neutrino. And moreover, the brain bulk couplings are flavor blind. A minimal kind of model.
Is this natural in the sense
of being? It's completely natural if you want to take the philosophical perspective that flavor is something unique to the standard model and it's on the brain, but not in the bulk. So if you want to imagine that flavor is a property to the brain for the standard model, but not in the bulk, then you're immediately led to this kind of thing. There is a flavor distinction. I didn't say the brain theory is flavor blind. It's not. It's flavor diagonal. That's the only thing that discriminates flavor, these three numbers right there. This is flavor blind. This is flavor neutral. So if I think of flavor, I mean, it's always a question of how do you want to conceive of flavor. I'd like to conceive of flavor for this as being something unique to the brain. And so then I'm immediately led to this. I don't necessarily. I just need something here which will distinguish between the flavors. Otherwise, I have a matrix which has a degenerate row and column, basically. Absolutely. This is just something very simple. So again, you can diagonalize, and what you find is the usual thing as you would expect. Oscillations happen from a brain neutrino through the bulk back to the brain. And so what I wind up having are flavor oscillations on the brain, e to mu, mu to tau, e to tau, each one happening not because of a mixing angle on the brain, but indirectly through the bulk and back to a different one on the brain. So here's a case where I can have flavor oscillations on the brain. Even if the brain theory is flavor diagonal, the bulk theory is flavor neutral, and the brain bulk coupling is flavor blind. And this is only five parameters, or four dimensionless parameters, and this would in principle give all masses and mixings. Yes, somehow or other, presumably in this case by dynamics on the brain, I'm going to have to introduce this splitting. I'm just taking this as an input. I'm still going to have some theory on the brain which does that. I'm not trying to explain flavor. I'm just trying to explain neutrinos in this way. Okay, so what happens here is that you can wind up getting all sorts of interesting neutrino patterns, and I'll just show a few oscillations. This is what happens if you wind up having, for example, degeneracies on the brain. You wind up, here's what happens if I have a degeneracy, this is a mass splitting in radius units, dimensionless radius units, between a muon neutrino on the brain and an electron neutrino on the brain. If I don't have much degeneracy, I don't get much mixing, but remember, this is all happening through the bulk. There's no mixing angle on the brain between E and mu. This is all through the bulk. But then, as I have more and more of a degeneracy on the brain, I wind up getting what look like two-state maximal mixing angles on the brain. It looks like a two-state oscillation. And this is happening, looks like maximal mixing, but it's happening with no mixing angle on the brain at all. The standard model is still flavor diagonal, and yet we have what looks like almost a complete flavor conversion. Moreover, notice that this is happening in a slightly deformed way. The bulk is really participating in a hidden way with this oscillation, and consequently the time average of these is not a half, it's actually about a third. So it's lower, and again, this is just sort of a vacuum oscillation here. So the physics is similar, but looks a little bit different, and I don't really have time to go through the model in detail, but I just want to show you that things don't look like the usual scenarios. Here's a plot of all sorts of flavor conversions and their time-averaged values. And again, this is just happening with those five parameters, nothing else. All of this rather rich physics is emerging just from choosing different values of those parameters.
There's no oscillation to the bulk?
Everything is going through the bulk. There aren't. This is all no mixing angles on the brain. This is the MNS matrix diagonal.
But you don't go to sterile at all?
You're going to sterile, but you're coming back, and that's why...
You don't end up at all?
You do leave some in the sterile. Okay, very good. I'm coming to that right now.
So. There is effectively a mixing, a flavor mixing, which is generated by this...
Exactly. This is bulk-mediated neutrino oscillations. Absolutely. I've been saved. Okay. Let me talk about the MSW effect, because now it's very relevant again to talk about the MSW effect, because we're talking about a scenario which has very small mixing angles. Very small mixing angles means we have a scenario, again, where the MSW effect on the brain might be very relevant. So let me just remind you how it works. You all know this, of course. We're going to have resonant oscillations in the usual four-dimensional scenario between, let's say, E and mu, which are occurring because of matter effects in the sun. Basically, as the electron neutrino propagates in the sun or the muon neutrino propagates, both of these can have neutral current interactions with the electrons that exist in the sun, but the charged current interactions can only occur for the electron neutrino. So effectively, the masses of the electron and muon neutrinos get shifted by effective contributions from the neutral current, and in this case the charge current also contributions. So the effective neutrino masses become functions of the electron density in the sun, and what happens is as you propagate out from the core to the edge, you all know this very well, the effective masses of these things cross until there's a resonant oscillation, which happens here when these cross. So at first, these are far from each other. They have different values. There's a very small or no mixing angle between these. So the probability of electron staying electron and electron changing to muon don't change. They start at 1 and 0 at the core. And this continues until you reach this region when they become degenerate. Suddenly, you fall into a two-state maximal scenario. So you begin to oscillate. E begins to convert to mu. Mu begins to convert to E. But it doesn't get very far because, again, you're propagating out, you've fallen out of the oscillation again, this stops, and you've only converted a little bit. This is the MSW effect. It's a resonant MSW flavor conversion. And the question now... Yeah. Oh, you can convert much more. I'm just giving a picture. Yeah, I'm not trying to review all of MSW. Thanks. So what happens now? Well, now we don't have any mixing angle at all. It's actually zero on the brain. So what happens is you have no conversion here directly between E and mu. What is mixing, though, is between the physics on the brain and the physics in the bulk. And so what happens is you now have a situation where you're going through MSW sequences between the physics on the brain and the physics in the bulk, and you wind up getting a whole Kaluza-Klein cascade like this. So here's nu E, and just for various numbers I've plotted this, and you see nu E converts to, in this, for these numbers, the eighth Kaluza-Klein state. So you drop a little bit, and you dump some probability into the eighth Kaluza-Klein. Then it drops a little bit more as you pass the threshold for the seventh. And you drop a little bit more as you pass the threshold for the sixth. This is the scenario first talked about by Diwali and Smirnov, for example. So what's happening is as you're going along, you're dropping probability into all the Kaluza-Klein modes as you go. Well, most models in the literature which talk about neutrinos and extra dimensions have this going on. The problem is now that experiments, Snow, Camland, are all suggesting that there's really not much neutrino flux in sterile neutrinos, and this is dumping lots of flux into sterile neutrinos. But it turns out that in this model, don't forget that the sterile neutrinos are also mixing with the other flavors as well. So this model also gives you flavor conversion. So again, you have the same scenario we had before. I'm only plotting the first dumping of probability from nu E into the eighth Kaluza-Klein mode. But now what happens is sooner, and I'm not even going to talk about the others yet, but N8 and M8, these are the eighth Kaluza-Klein modes, they eventually hit now the resonance for the muon neutrinos. And so what happens is you now trade that probability back into muons and you lose it from the Kaluza-Klein states. And so you've effectively pumped your probability from the one flavor into another flavor and depleted it back from the bulk again. So this is a flavor conversion, which again I stress, this is the MSW effect without mixing angles on the brain at all. And what's also interesting relative to the four-dimensional case is that because you're involving sterile neutrinos in the process, the charged and neutral currents affects matter separately, which doesn't happen in the usual four-dimensional case. This is a flavor-neutral theory on the brain. So what would be nice to understand is whether or not it would be possible to build a model where even though the electron neutrino is littering all sorts of probability into the right-handed Kaluza-Klein states in the bulk, you can then have your muon neutrino follow like a vacuum cleaner and suck it all back up again into probability for complete conversion into active probability without having any flavor, without having any sterile neutrino flux left. I should talk briefly about what happens when the brain-bulk couplings get large. This model is unique because it has the property that as the brain-bulk coupling gets large, only one-third of the initial neutrino probability is ever lost into bulk states. 2/3 of the initial probability always remains on the brain, and this is different from all the other models where you have, when you do have flavor in the bulk, 3 bulk neutrinos, turns out that as the brain-bulk coupling gets large, all the flux inevitably is lost into sterile neutrinos, which certainly isn't what we see experimentally. So this kind of model still has a chance to survive with current data, and that's something worth looking at. It's possible that this model can also evade perhaps the usual four-dimensional supernova bounds, which ordinarily restrict the sizes of mixings into sterile neutrinos. Okay, I have 2 minutes or so? 1 minute. All right. You see me taking off a clip from another stack, but I'm not going to go through it all. I just want to suggest very quickly that axions, you can do the same physics for axions, because axions are also singlets under the standard model symmetries, so they can propagate into the bulk. That can be used to lower the Peutz-Jeghquin scale, indeed. Same physics, I'm not even going to show you, but it's the same idea, so I don't even need a high Peutz-Jeghquin scale. But there are 3 effects which are interesting. You have an infinite diagonal mass matrix, non-diagonal mass matrix, you diagonalize, you do all the mixings again. First effect is that when the radius gets large, the axion mass again saturates at the inverse radius. It becomes independent of the Peutz-Jeghquin scale, which is something you don't have the power to break, that relation between the Peutz-Jeghquin scale and the axion mass in 4 dimensions. You do have the power to break it here. That's one interesting effect. The second interesting effect is that just like neutrinos, you now have a non-diagonal mass matrix for axions. So axions undergo laboratory oscillations just like the neutrino oscillations. I'm not talking about the relic axion oscillations. I'm talking about neutrino-like oscillations. And that could be a reason why you can't detect them. Because here's what happens if you plot the neutrino-like oscillations for axions. The more axions participate, you find that the structure of the mass matrix in the axion case is such that the probability falls to zero and never comes back. In other words, the axion decoheres into the extra dimensions. It's different than what happens in the neutrino case, where it does oscillate back. So what happens is axions, in this case, decohere very rapidly, become invisible on a time scale of 10 to the minus 33 seconds. So that might be one contributing factor to axion invisibility. And then finally, you can talk about cosmological relic axion oscillations. The upper bound on the Peutz-Jeghquin scale is usually set because the energy trapped in the cosmological relic oscillations of the axions, even today, would overclose the universe. You have a damped oscillation of the axion field, which even today would have too much energy to overclose the universe. So that sets a scale for the Peutz-Jeghquin scale. But in higher dimensions, what happens is you now have many KK modes. They're all coupled together. You ask what happens is one of these oscillations triggers all the other higher modes into oscillation. You ask what happens, and just to show you the final plot, what winds up happening is that when the extra dimensions get large, you win. The extra Kaluza-Klein modes steal the energy from the zero mode, and they dissipate it more efficiently. So extra dimensions actually end up dissipating the axion relic oscillation energy faster, which loosens the bound on the Peutz-Jeghquin scale. So this opens up a new way of thinking about axion phenomenology as well. Okay, so I think I should end there. Thank you. Sorry, what? Sorry?
Model.
Yes. Yes. Again, one has to be very careful about how one constructs the model. There are all these effects. The first important thing is you can't dump probability into the sterile neutrinos. You've got to get it back in some way. This is an important constraint. People have looked at the BBN constraints as well. There are a number of papers. There are constraints, but again, I don't believe this is ruled out at all. I can show you the actual papers if you want. I don't know enough about it to tell you exactly the number. Again, maybe you can tell me. Yes? Right. Well, I'm not getting rid of SUSY. Some of the people who first promoted this tried to say that this was a...
but you don't have SUSY down to the 0.01 EV
limit. Oh, no, certainly not. So you have to find a new mechanism for generating a large radius and then for stabilizing the large radius. There are many methods. in the literature. For example, you can have trapped fluxes, gauge flux charges, so the extra dimensions can't contract. You can have string winding modes which wrap around the extra dimension, like the original Brandenburger-Vafa ideas, so you can't expand the extra dimension too much because there's a string wrapped. There are all sorts of geometric issues. I don't want to say this is a solution to the hierarchy problem. I never said that word. What it is a new guise to the hierarchy problem. It's a way of thinking about the hierarchy problem in terms of the physics of geometry as opposed to the physics of an energy space. It's a Fourier transform. Instead of energy space, we have physical space. Let me first get the fluxes to be the right numbers. I mean, these are important questions, but I think this really has to get down to the model building stage. Until recently with SNOW, people had these models where you dumped, you explained the solar flux just by dumping physics into the sterols, and now we know we can't do that. So again, this whole field is going to have to take a turn to try to do it in a different way, and I'm just suggesting how that might be done.
Just a qualitative question. If I'm oscillating from the brain into the ball,
right,
effectively sterile neutrino,
mm-hmm,
do they contribute to the energy density?
They do, but usually what happens, I showed it for the axions, what happens is they usually dissipate it more rapidly. In other words, trading physics from the brain into the bulk and having all the oscillations happen there dissipates things more rapidly than it would have if it had just been on the brain.
Do I have then fewer than three neutrinos in such a scenario?
You mean effectively?
Effectively.
I don't know. That would be an interesting question. Probably not, but I don't want to say yes. Somebody said no. You know all about this. Yeah. The next talk we'll talk more about sterile neutrinos.
You have so many parameters inside the model.
Yeah. Well, the model I showed was a very minimal one with one fewer parameter than the usual MNS.
An experimental.
Yeah. Right.
An upper bound on the size of that convention.
Right. Right, absolutely. Yeah. Not yet, but it will begin to eventually. Not yet. Again, there are issues in the interpretation of those results. I had a paper on a different topic completely, which the point of which was basically to say that those bounds really aren't bounds on the size of the largest extra dimension. And there are ways of evading the Adelberger types of bounds.
I think we should call it here. We're running about 10 minutes late. We call it very slow. So let's get back here around 5 after 1. I have 5 after 11. I have about 19 left. Thank you.